It'll work. We'll see. All right. So if you haven't gotten there, turn to Psalm 139. I'm going to give you my answers, and then I'll try to remember where this goes into the whatever lesson as we go. So someone who knows you and how it affects you, I'm glad to hear that you guys didn't all give wonderful, fluffy answers, because my answer for someone who knows me really well and how it affects me is kind of, it's just creepy and cringe. I have a colleague at work who's one of those people, and part of this is my personality, but he just wants to be your friend. And like, I think the best friendships are coincidental. Like one of the worst ways to be my friend is to want to be my friend. You know what I mean? It just kind of has to happen. And so I say that because like, this guy knows everything about me. Like it's creepy. Like he walks by at lunch and he's like, "Oh, Zach, I see you only brought 2 barbecue sauces today instead of 3. Like, serious as a heart attack, not making this up. You know, or I'm like walking by his classroom and I'm not saying anything. And he's like, "Hey, Zach." I'm like, and he, you know, I come in, I'm like, "What's up?" I was like, "How'd you know it was me?" He's like, "Oh, I know your gait." Like really, like it's creepy, okay? But I tell you this, those of you who work there are all trying to think, who is it? Anyway, but I tell you that because it is one thing to be known, but it's not an automatic thing to say that for someone to know you well equates to, you know, a comforting, happy, good thing. I'm glad that it does. And I say that because today's lesson is going to be about how God knows us. And the fact that that directs us into comfort and joy. Because it could be the case that God could know us and that could be terrifying, right? Like, you know, "Oh my goodness, he knows all the terrible things about us, blah, 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 blah." But that's going to be a comforting and sweet thing. Something that directed and or influenced the course of our life. Remind me, if you would, please, when we get to focus directed, 17 and 18, I'll share that story in the hope that it'll be worthwhile. And then something you can't get enough of, I already told you guys about, you know, ice cream and Lord of the Rings and stuff like that. Because I want to take a moment and note how the text opens and closes. So, I'll tell you what, how about this? Let me ask Andrew in a moment, if you'll read verse 1, Psalm 139, verse 1, and then, let's see, Fisher, if you're game, you don't have to, would you read verses 23 and 24 just immediately after Andrew finishes verse 1, and I'll tell you what this has to do with something you can't get enough of, if you would, please. Go ahead, sir. If that's true, you got me. Go ahead, I'm sorry. What's up? Oh, I'm sorry, I thought, you're going to read for him? She's going to rescue you, man. She's going to rescue. Okay, go for it, ma'am.
Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. If there is any offensive way in me, lead me in the way everlasting.
Beautiful. Okay, so the reason why I wanted to start with that, the beginning and the end, is because apparently the psalmist, David, if you read the subtitle, Psalm 139 is written by David, apparently the psalmist couldn't get enough of God searching him and knowing him. The text opens with, "You have searched me and known me, O Lord." And it ends with, verse 23, "Search me, O God, and know my heart." So you have known me, please know me more. You have searched me, please search me more. And for what purpose? Keep going in 23 and 24. Put me to the test and know my anxious thoughts. Isn't this amazing, by the way? Like, just lay it out there. Put me under the microscope. Examine me. Test me. Find my flaws and fix them. You want to talk about having some serious comfort level with somebody knowing you to be able to say that. And that's what David wants. And see if there is any hurtful way in me and lead me in the everlasting way. Does anybody in verse 24 have "see if there is any wicked way in me"? Something like that. It also says hurtful? Okay, fair enough. Okay, thank you. Anyway, point is, the point I'm trying to get at is, in the course of this psalm, David goes from celebrating the fact that God knows him well to wanting God to know him even more and to change him and make him more like him. Beautiful stuff. So, how do we get there? Well, let's take it a chunk at a time. So for the first, I don't know, two-thirds of the psalm, I think the theme is going to be constant intimacy, looking at how close God is. And so for the first six verses, I want to suggest that the focus is on the circumstances, that God knows me in all circumstances. So in a moment, we're going to read verses 1-6. Just look for the, I don't know, emotional effects of God knowing our circumstances well, and what that brings about in David, particularly in verse 6. So this time I'll throw it open. Sometimes I'm asking people directly. And by the way, here's my all-inclusive standard. As a believer in Ropes Course, by the way, Ropes Course taught me way more about teaching than my education degree ever did. But Ropes Course, one of the things that we say is challenge by choice. You only do a challenge if you choose to do so. Otherwise, it turns into trauma because you were forced to do it. And that's not, like, really, that's not, I mean, not like serious trauma, but you know what I mean? That kind of thing. So anyway, anytime I ask you to read or whatever, please, or pray or whatever, please don't feel like you have to. All right, enough of that. If somebody'd be so kind as to read the first six verses, let's look at God's constant intimacy with us in all circumstances. Take it away, man.
The Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You shortcut my path and my lying down. And you are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, what will the Lord, you know it all better. You hem me in, bind me before, and lay your hand on me. Knowledge is too wonderful for me. I cannot.
Beautiful. Excuse me. Yeah. So. I don't have anything in mind yet, but any part of that section that just is salient to you, is gripping to you, is like, wow, that's a beautiful image or a sweet image or anything like that.
Verse 3, you search out my path, so saying the Lord out, is it just the path he's on?
Hear, hear. No matter where you go, whatever your path is, the Lord is with you. I was thinking about this for some of you guys. I know a handful of you guys either are starting or have started new jobs or new positions in those jobs, and the Lord is with you. Like, I know that sounds really corny or whatever, but like, you walk into that interview or you walk into this new client or you walk into this cold call and the Lord is with you. Like, you don't go into it alone. Anything else that struck anybody from those first six verses?
Maybe verse 2. Because I heard. You're laughing because it's true. And so I like that. Speaking from like a mom perspective.
Yeah, that is sweet. Beautifully said. Yeah, that's true. I have no idea if this is true for all, maybe not all. I don't know if this is true for most moms versus dads or whatever, but I mean, we had a probably 7 to 8 minute conversation about all the different ways Hallie could pack Brent's lunch this morning. And I was just like, you just put it in a box. Like, that's not, but anyway. So, but no, for real, like that shows how much she loves him in all seriousness. But the fact that God knows that she is going to think about, you know, what's the most efficient, most long lasting, most cold pack keeping, most minimum space occupying way to pack this child's lunch. That's amazing. So there you go. See? Beautiful. I love it. I love it. So for me, verse 4, even before, maybe this is more close to me, even before there is a word on my tongue, O Lord, you know it. Just, that's a, I don't know, that's just a beautiful thought. He knows what I'm going to say before I even say it. And something else I want you to notice is, look what this does to David. Verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me, it is too high, I cannot comprehend it. Just the It leads him to praise. It leads him to marvel. It leads him to humility to accept this. I feel like, and this could be wrong, like for real, correct me. I feel like those of us who grew up in the 90s and early noughts, which I guess is none of you guys, or maybe it is, I guess the high school and stuff like that was the early noughts or mid noughts. Anyway, self-esteem was the big thing. you know, you're worthy, you know, you're worth it. You know, Oprah was in her heyday and blah, 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 blah. But I say that because that's not the direction that David takes it. David takes it not about, you know, oh, how great I am, but about how wonderful I praise you. How delightful are your thoughts to me? I think that's noteworthy. Two stories in the attempts to sink this in. I'll tell the less important one first. So one of my favorite recent new movies is American Fiction. If you haven't seen it and you have a humor like mine, it's a fantastic film. But there's this part in the film, and I'm bringing this back. I'll try to make the story quick because the reason I tell you stories is stories add weight to points. Like, you know, if I tell you God is good, that's great. If I tell you about how God rescued me from X, Y, and Z, it really hits harder. So anyway, so in American Fiction, they have this beach house. It's the family beach house. You know, they all share ownership of it or whatever. And there's a member of the family who's going to have her wedding. And, you know, her wedding is going to happen at the beach house. And so they get there the morning of to, you know, whatever, open it up and stuff like that. And the prodigal brother, if you will, who has left his wife to pursue open homosexual relationships and engages in drug use recreationally, is there. And he had come over the weekend unannounced. And like, so she walks in on the morning of her wedding day, and there's two guys in Speedos and the brother, and there's this Coke laid out on the coffee table and stuff like that. And of course, the brother feels terrible, you know, and he's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to impose. And the sister takes him. She's not the sister, but I'm just going to say that for simplicity's sake. The bride takes him and says, you can't impose. You're family. And I just say that because it's this beautiful picture of how in all circumstances you are accepted and received and loved. You know, it's my wedding day and you're here with your homosexual friends doing coke on my coffee table and you're still welcome here. Like, but I say that because that's what God does to us. Now, look, don't get into homosexual relationships and do drugs and stuff like that. But like that, that's how much God is always with us and intimately acquainted with us and loves us. The more important story that it made me think of, remember the triptych, original audience, Jesus, and then us. But, you know, Jesus is always with us, which sounds really corny, right? Matthew 28, now I can't remember what it is. I think it's 19. Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. But he is. And he's not just with us. Remember, God became man in Jesus Christ so that he could empathize with us in every way possible. You know what it's like not to be understood? He gets that. You know what it's like to be utterly alone and betrayed and left by the people closest to you? He gets that. You know what it's like to feel a celebratory moment with your family? He gets that. Like, everything that we experience, he experienced first so that he can intimately be with us. And I just think that's a beautiful and wonderful thing. By the way, if you want a text for that, I should have told you, you should take notes so you can get all these verses I'm going to reference. But Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, we do not have a high priest who is not familiar with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in every way like as we are. What a beautiful Jesus. And I say that because whatever our circumstances, the thing we need most at every moment in the world is to marvel at Jesus, to be awed by his beauty and goodness, and to be satisfied in him. Okay, don't worry. I see the time. We'll see how much further we get. We'll see how the others go. So let's go to 7 and 12. Still on constant intimacy. But this time, I think the focus is going to move from God is with us in all circumstances to God is with us in all geography, wherever we go, which to us as Christians is kind of a duh-huh thing, but not necessarily to the original audience. But let's just look at the effect and the power of the images David uses in verses 7 through 12. If somebody pick those up, please.
Where can I go through your spirit? Where can I flee from you? If I go up to the heavens, I make my bed. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me back. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light will come night around me, and the darkness will not be dark to me. The night will shine like the day, the darkness will be dark.
I'll take maybe one, max two answers just for the sake of time, but anything in that particular section that jumps out at you just as being emotionally effective or noteworthy? Hear, hear. Yeah, there will be times when, you know, you're in darkness. There are times you will make your bed in Sheol, the underworld, figuratively speaking, but not by much. Like, there's rough times in life, man. And there's great times when you're up in the heavens, if you will. And either way, the Lord our God is right there with us. You know, he's not a fair weather friend, if you will. And that's just beautiful. And just passing by, not a huge deal, but worth at least mentioning, think about the power of this for David to say this about God being the God of all the earth. If you want to look it up, and don't look it up now, but there's a story in 1 Kings chapter 20 where the Arameans and the Israelites are fighting, and they have their first fight. I'm going to get it mixed up. I can't remember which one's which, but they have their first fight in the fields. And the Arameans lose, and they come back again, and they say, well, their God is a God of the fields. Let us fight them in the mountains. And the second fight is in the mountains, and of course, the Israelites still win. But the point of the story is that Israel's God is not a local deity. He is God everywhere. And that's a big deal for, you know, Old Testament times. Again, for us as Christians, we've kind of grown up with that, so we expect that. But our God is with us in all places. You know, Hallie and I got some tickets that one of my students is, got tickets to one of my students' big fancy dance recitals come Christmas in downtown Atlanta. So I will probably need Hallie to remind me as we are driving to this recital that God is with me in downtown Atlanta. Not like it's the drive. It's not like anything else. Just you guys have heard my thing about how if I could hire a personal chauffeur for the rest of my life, I would do it in a heartbeat. But the Lord is going to be with me there. Just like the Lord is with me when I go back to Pennsylvania and drive down every back road and can drive 40 miles and see two cars in the course of that entire drive and love it. The Lord is with us wherever we go. And that is such a fantastic and glorious and wonderful thing. All right, let's keep going, please. One more focus on constant, lots of T's and N's and I's in here. One more focus on constant intimacy, this time on our biology and our biography. God is not just present with us in our circumstances. He's not just present with us wherever we are. He is present with us in the very makeup of our being and in the very layout of our days. And what a glorious and fantastic thing that is. So if somebody be so gracious as to pick it up in verse 13 and read through 16. Think so? Oh. Yeah, hold off on 17. We'll get to that. Thank you. I don't know, even just as we sit here and read that, it strikes me how marvelously beautiful it is that the Lord God made us and prepared every day for us. It's all written in his book, whatever the next day holds. You know, it's the God who knows you this intimately has written it all out. The God who knit your very bones together in your mother's womb, you know, not literally in the dark places of the earth, but figuratively so. Like, that's still the God who's over all your days. That hits hard. I mean, it might not hit hard in the Sunday school room, right? Let's be honest. But I'm going to go to some hard places here. But, you know, if you got to take your parents or your grandparents to an assisted living place, your God is still, if they're Christians, your God is still with them, even in those difficult moments. Your God is with you when bad things happen. You know, I don't know, God forbid your kid gets injured in a football game or something like that. That's football. That's so stereotypical. Your kid gets injured in a cross-country race. Do you guys remember, this is probably 10 years ago now, but do you remember the meme when those deer ran through the cross-country race and trucked those kids over? No, it's a thing. You can look it up on the internet. It's a video. This cross-country race going through a field, and suddenly these like three deer go running across the field and just truck a couple of these kids. Anyway, God knew that was going to happen, and that was part of his plan for those poor children. Anyway, this is going to go on the internet, and one of those kids is going to email me and tell me that he's turned away from Christianity now because God sent that deer. But anyway, but the Lord is with you in all those things. The Lord had written how the prom date would turn out, and that, you know, Ms. Post would teach accounting, or that a football coach would say something. Like, those were all things that the Lord had ordained for us. All right, so now, what's that going to do for us? Like, now we're going to move from the constant intimacy, the realization of God's imminence, into how's that direct our focus and our passion? So if somebody would read verses 17 to 18, I want to see, in light of all this intimacy, in light of all this personal love, where does David's heart go? It's very interesting. What direction, God bless you, what direction does it take? So if somebody would read verses 17 through 18.
How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. I awake, I am still with
you. Love it. Thank you. Again, maybe it's because I'm a child of the 80s, 90s knots when, you know, self-esteem and everything else was amazing, but it's amazing to me that all this turns David's attention Godward and not inward. You know, at least for me, growing up in the culture I grew up in, the temptation would be, oh, look how wonderfully made I am. And I've seen this happen in Christian circles, and like, hear me right, okay? I'm not against spiritual gift inventories and stuff like that, but I've seen this happen where you take the spiritual gift inventory or whatever, you take the test and you find out you've got this gift or this bent or that personality, and you make it about you, right? Like, look at how great I am. Look at what I can do, blah, 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 blah. That's not the direction David goes with this. Like, instead of thinking about, oh, how wonderful I am and how great are my gifts, David says, how precious are your thoughts for me, O God. His attention goes to God. I call this cat Christian versus dog Christian. This is an old preacher story. I didn't make it up. But, you know, dogs see that you provide for them and you love them and you give them everything you need and you organize everything, and they come to the conclusion that you must be God. Cats see the fact that you provide for them everything and you take care of their every need and you give them attention and you love them, and they come to the conclusion that they must be God. And so the question... The question is, are we cat Christians or are we dog Christians? Do we see the great love that God has given to us, and do we direct that inward or do we direct that outward toward what a great God he is? And just passing comment, note when David says, how precious are your thoughts for me, O God, where is he going to get those thoughts? Answer, in the Bible that's been written thus far. You know, obviously the whole Bible hadn't been written yet, but that's what David's thinking about. Even, look at the end of verse 18, when I awake, I am still with you. First thing that pops in his mind when he wakes up is the thoughts of God, the word of God, the stuff he's meditated on, that kind of thing. All right. So, by the way, just if you care, I'll skip over it really fast because we're running out of time, but if you read the group me, for me, the thing that eventually made me realize, I think this teaching thing might be something I could do full time, was that I had to, and some of you were like, wrong decision. But anyway, I remember we did this basically gigantic summer reading thing in my school at Sewanee and University, where everybody read the same book, and then they would pick a couple of the English majors to give a talk or whatever. And so we read Wendell Berry, who is a great author. But I remember, like, I can see the room. I can see the balcony and the floor, and like, it was a big room, 400 people or so. And I'm talking to them about Barry, and I'm actually interacting with them back and forth. And like, I can feel the moment when it was like, I'm having a good time here. And they seem to be learning a thing. And this is something I could do. Anyway, my point is that passion directed my focus toward teaching. And in the same way, the realization of God's intimacy should direct us toward praise. Let's see. Let me just say this quickly, and I know this isn't very fair, especially to the text, but I'm going to attempt to choose the lesser of two evils and just toss this out there. If you read 19 through 22, it gets, for us, weird and uncomfortable. Constant intimacy, how great are your thoughts? And then suddenly, were I to, excuse me, 19. If you would only put the wicked to death, God. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Straight flow. If you would only put the wicked to death, God, leave me, you men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate, strong words, those who hate you, Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. So this would be like talk number three of that whole, you know, three talks over the course of the weekend. What gives? Now look, there's all kinds of stuff to say, and please don't go out of here and be like, okay, let's hate non-Christians and da 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 da. I don't think that's what David's trying to get us to see. Jesus was very clear where to love our enemies. But what I do want you to see is that David lets his love for God be the thing that directs his passion. His passion lines up with his God. That's what makes him love what he loves and hate what he hates. By the way, again, if you've read the stories, you know David doesn't go around killing non-Christians. He entrusts it to God, but his feelings are affected by his love for God. You know, when you find out that they need help with the kids or special needs or whatever, does our love for God compel us to consider, can I solve that problem? You know, when you see somebody lost at church, or when you got new neighbors, or, you know, when you have that creepy guy that you work with who knows your gate and wants you to come talk to him, does your passion for God move you to love those people in a way that they ought to be loved, as opposed to, I think I left the kettle on, or, you know, whatever else it might be. So I know that was very, very fast, but the idea I at least want to throw at you is that our love for the Lord and the realization of his love for us should direct our passions a certain way. And then I pretty much already told you this with the whole something you can't get enough of. The more we realize God's love for us, if you really get it, the more of it you want, because it's a painful process. It's hard to let God, you know, Hebrews says, our God is a consuming fire. And when you fall into his hands, he refines you and makes you. But man, whew, is the end product. And is the end product, or the next step in the process even, just so worth it? Because he's such a good God. All right, that was really long. I hope it was helpful. Final comments, corrections, additions, etc. Well, you're kind. Again, the goal is life. One of my life maxims, the goal is not to be good. The goal is to be helpful. So I hope it was helpful. Let's see, I was actually legit going to pick on Micah to pray us out, but he got the memo. He knew the word before it was on my lips. So anyway, let's see. Nathan, if you're willing, would you close us out, please?
Lord, thank you for this message that Zach brought to us. Let's just keep it on our minds and going forward that God is there for us as we go into our week. God already knows the day that's coming up tomorrow. And we need to lean into that. Be with us, be with our families, be safe as we come home and where we're going. It's in your name we pray.
Amen.